Good morning. Senior Judge Ryan is sitting with us telephonically. She, of course, may ask questions just like anyone else, but I will at the end assure that she has a chance to ask any questions she wants to ask. Before I start, I thank you all for your condolences. It meant a lot to me and the family. First case, United States v. Scott. Appellant ready to argue?
We are, Your Honor.
The government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Good morning, members of the court. I'm William Casera, and on behalf, and along with Major Kyle Sprague, we represent the appellant in this case, Major Jason Scott, and Judge Stuckey. I just wanted to personally express my condolences as well.
Thank you.
The appellant was denied the effective assistance of counsel when his defense counsel, believing a dismissal was off the table, failed to investigate appellant's military history, and failed to call several witnesses who could testify to his bravery in combat. The appellant was prejudiced by this deficiency when he was dismissed from the service.
Mr. Casera, could you speak up a little?
Sir.
Thanks.
The appellant was prejudiced by this deficiency when he was dismissed from the service, losing his vested retirement after over 20 years of honorable service. As such, this court should set aside the sentence in this case. Very briefly, the standard of review in this case, as this court knows for IAC claims, is de novo under U.S. v. Anderson. We must show that the counsel's performance was deficient and that this deficiency prejudiced the appellant.
Okay, Mr. Casera, I have two questions.
Yes, sir.
Up front. Number one, I think you answered one question. Number one question is, what do you want? And you want the sentence set aside and you want a new sentencing proceeding. Am I correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Question two. Given the contours of the offense to which the accused pled guilty, i.e., consensual sexual activity by a commissioned officer of the Army with the wife of a senior enlisted member of the Army, how's there prejudice here? Isn't this the kind of thing that, regardless of what defense counsel could do, was going to result in a dismissal anyhow?
To the contrary, Your Honor. And I think that that's borne out in a couple of different things. First off, the defense counsel, for whatever deficiencies may have happened in this case, did a survey of the landscape, so to speak, and found that a dismissal was not a likely result. In fact, he had written a dismissal off as being an extremely unlikely result, bordering on improbable. And secondly, obviously, Judge, there's no way that we can look into a crystal ball and say, had the military judge known about his bravery in combat, the result would have 100% been different. We can't. But under the standards of Porter v. McCollum, which we recently cited to this court, the standard is, can you have confidence in the verdict? And we would submit that you cannot. And that had the military judge known about his bravery in combat, a dismissal would not have been a likely possibility in this case. All criminal defendants are entitled to counsel at every step in the process.
Mr. Casera, could I go
yes,
back?
Judge.
I hate to
no.
throw you off your argument, but on Judge Stuckey's point, couldn't the military judge, I mean, he had the accused officer qualification record, or I can't remember what they called in the Army, but couldn't he have seen the accused career and all of his accomplishments in his officer qualification record? And if that's the case, would the physical presence of these witnesses have made more of a difference?
Absolutely, Judge. The officer record brief of which you speak is a snapshot. It lists chronologically a number of assignments. It does not list what that person did in any detail during that assignment. So, for example, when Colonel Fee came in and talked about him flying at 200 feet above during smoke and being shot at and saving American lives, the officer record brief is completely vacuous as it relates to that particular, and that's just one example, Judge.
Is the basic problem here, from your point of view, that if you boil it down, that defense counsel, who has a duty to conduct a reasonable investigation, did not investigate? And my understanding is that he didn't even talk to these witnesses.
That is correct. The counsel has a duty to take adequate steps to identify mitigation and evaluate information that has been brought to their attention. They have an obligation to reasonably investigate. I'm sorry, members of the court. I'm shifting one way or another as the court has expanded in size. And the counsel clearly failed in his obligation. In fact, Your Honor, Judge Barks, in reference to your point, bravery in combat is specifically listed as a matter in mitigation under RCM 1001. The client had brought five names to the attention of the defense counsel who could speak to their bravery. There's this discussion during the debate session as to whether he handed him a written list, did he email a list to the defense counsel, did he just talk about his exploits in combat. I would submit to you that as the DuBay judge found, one, the defense counsel had those names, but two, it is not the client's responsibility to go through and say, here is what I did. That is the essence of what a defense counsel does. The client provided...
But that's only one prong of Strickland. You're focusing strictly on the issue of the deficiency of the performance of counsel. Getting back to the point that the chief judge raised, when we're looking at a quote, reasonable probability, end quote, that the result of the sentencing would have been different, as the chief judge was noting, these were very egregious facts. This was not just a run-of-the-mill adultery. This involved an officer engaging in adultery with a senior enlisted member who was in a combat zone himself. And we have the CCA referring itself in its own opinion as a very egregious instance. So where do we find the reasonable probability that the result of this sentencing would have been different?
Your Honor, I'd like to respond in two ways. First off, yes, this was an egregious case of adultery. It is noteworthy that when the adultery started, he did not know that she was married. And in fact, when he was given the order, as you recall from the testimony, when he was told to stay away from her, he came out of it crushed. That basically the woman that he thought that he was going to be spending the rest of his life with had been lying to him. Does that excuse in any way the conduct afterwards? Absolutely not. Is it a matter in mitigation? It absolutely is. Secondly, in direct response to your question as to where do we find the prejudice, we find the prejudice in the matters submitted by the defense counsel during the DuBay hearing and submitted by the appellant in his affidavit to the court. Those matters being the significant matters in bravery as evidenced by five officers who served with him in combat. And I think what's important to note here, Judge, is that when the appellant was originally tried, his defense counsel put on three, as the Army Court said, middling witnesses, with regards to, yeah, I've worked with him for a few months and he's an above average officer. That gives the military judge no sort of an idea as to what this person did in combat. And in fact, if you look at his ORB, during the time in combat, he's listed as a staff officer. That gives you no indication as to what he was doing. The Distinguished Flying Cross for which he was submitted, while it was downgraded, speaks of incredible heroic bravery. And those are the exact sort of things that both RCM 1006 and Porter v. McCollum discuss that this nation has always given credit to for those who have committed criminal offenses.
At the same time, the testimony of the witnesses who did testify would not have been wiped from the record. And they did give, as the CC indicated, middling testimony. So when we're looking at this, where you point out that he didn't know that the woman was married at the beginning, but there's so much more to the record here, Mr. Casera, in terms of this was not a fairy tale romance. He's referring to the woman as a whore in the text messages. He's making very disparaging comments about the NCO, talking about how, well, maybe he can polish or wash my motorcycle to earn a few bucks. And then most egregiously, referring to at the time when the NCO is in combat, talking about to the wife, maybe you'll get lucky, when it's in the context of individuals in that unit being killed in Afghanistan. So how do we play this out in terms of, you were saying at the beginning, we don't have a crystal ball, but we have to look at the standard of reasonable probability that there wouldn't be a dismissal. How do we get there?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways we get there, Judge. First off, I think it's important to note that, as the defense counsel pointed out, in many a case, one of the reasons why this court doesn't have a landscape, so to speak, of similar cases is because they frequently don't go to trial, that they are resolved with some other manner of disposition. Now, obviously, this court sees the cases that have gone to trial, and that's, you know, the snapshot that this court has. But secondly, as I was saying before, and I'm reminded of the quote from Porter v. McCollum, in which he said, the Supreme Court says, our nation has a long tradition of courting leniency to veterans in recognition of their service, especially those who fought on the front lines. That is exactly what we have in this
But
case.
Isn't that case distinguishable? There, the Supreme Court is talking about the civilians do not understand the ramifications of service, particularly service in the front lines during time of war. Here we're talking about a military court-martial. We have an 06 who's serving as the military judge. You don't think that he would understand the service that had been done looking at the ORB of the accused?
My recollection is the judge was an 05. I could be wrong, Judge, but the question is still the same. Is Porter distinguishable? One, it's a death penalty case. Of course it's distinguishable. But is the language of the Supreme Court guideful to this court in terms of determining prejudice? We would submit that it absolutely is. Because, and this is codified, and again, in RCM 1006, this court can look, when you look at the landscape and when you determine prejudice, I would ask this court to consider the following things. We must show a reasonable probability that absent the errors, the results of the proceeding would have been different. So the five witnesses all knew the appellant before he committed the misconduct. They would have testified to his rehabilitative potential in superlative terms. Colonel Fay, a fearless warrior who personally saved the lives of countless Americans in combat. Lieutenant Colonel A.S., Major Scott has served his country with incredible tenacity, bravery, and competence in the most horrific and dangerous of conditions. Chief Warrant Officer R.M., when the bullets started flying, he wanted to be at the tip of the spear. Chief Warrant Officer E.M., I want Major Scott on my side when the bullets start flying. All of whom knew about the misconduct in this case. Mr. J.R., appellant briefed General Mattis on a weekly basis and is one of the smartest and most competent officers I have ever met. The military judge knew none of this. This court, in now looking at this case, has what the military judge did not have. His officer enlisted performance reviews. The military judge never heard from any of these witnesses. He never knew about the distinguished flying cross or anything appellant did in combat. This court, RCM 1006 and Porter v. McCollum, can and should require more of a defense counsel. Whether the defense counsel did present evidence in mitigation, relevant to your question, Judge Olson, isn't the issue. It's part of the issue. But in fact, if anything, it shows the deficiency and the prejudice from that deficiency. Because he basically just mailed it in, put three witnesses up that he had no idea what they were going to say. In an unsworn statement that was unflattering to say the least.
Any questions I might have?
Judge Ryan.
Yes. So, Mr. Cassara, is your point that, well, the military judge certainly would be capable of understanding the ramifications of service on the front line, that in this case he wasn't apprised of what the service on the front line was?
Yes, Judge. I moved over to your phone. I'm not sure if I got all of your question, but yes, I believe the answer is yes. Because the
okay.
military judge was not apprised of what the appellant had done in combat.
Okay. And then my second question is, am I correct that your client raised in mitigation PTSD?
He raised it in this unsworn statement. It was not investigated by or pursued by the defense in any way. And it was, you know, as frequently happens in these cases, the military judge said, so are you disavowing any defense of criminal responsibility? He said yes. But he certainly did talk about his PTSD in his unsworn statement. Defense counsel did not follow up and did not present any evidence of that.
And then finally, does the record reflect how it came to be that the command became aware of the fact that this woman was married to an enlisted soldier?
I don't have that information, Judge. The government might. I don't have that information. I can certainly look again.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
I do have one last question,
yes, sir.
Mr. Cassera. Now, haven't the courts said that a member of the military officer corps has a special standing in society? And so, going back to your conversation with Judge Olson about Supreme Court cases or civilian cases that might reference this kind of a issue, I guess that's my first question. And the second part of that is, if the military officer is seen to occupy a special place in society, should his previous heroic conduct give him a permanent pass on future misconduct?
Oh, clearly not, Judge. But I think that it's important to recognize, as this court knows, this case would not have ended with Major Scott staying in the military as Major Scott and retiring. There are administrative penalties that would have been exacted upon him. There are grade determination review boards that would have been exacted upon him.
Should we be considering any of that, though?
Court can consider that in determining whether or not, had the military judge known of his heroic acts in combat, he would have adjudged a dismissal. We believe he would not have. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court?
Judge Ryan, do you have any further questions?
No, not at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cassar. Counsel for the government.
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Judge Stuckey, honorable judges of this court, may it please the court. My name is Captain T.J. Dharmafal, and together alongside Major Dustin Murray, we represent the United States. Appellant's defense counsel were not deficient because they succeeded in reducing what started as sexual assault charges against appellant all the way down to adultery and disobeying a lawful order. They interviewed all the witnesses appellant requested for pre-sentencing, secured an objectively favorable deal from the convening authority, presented evidence in extenuation and mitigation.
So, counsel, I'm sorry, but I have to just interrupt you up front, even though I said I wasn't going to. Was he ever charged with sexual offenses?
No, he was not, Your Honor.
Okay, so that has nothing to do with anything, does it?
Your Honor, it goes to show that the defense counsel, over the course of 8 months, advocated zealously on his behalf to make sure those charges were not brought against him. There was also information that the reason they took the case from a guilty plea over the course of 12 days is because there was a looming threat of the government preferring additional charges, which would endanger his client or put his client at risk of a more serious charge being brought against him.
Counsel, how is that really relevant? We've got this glaring deficiency on their part. Mr. Cassara went through talking about the testimony that would have been given. And yet the military judge was never provided with an opportunity to hear about his heroic and exemplary conduct in combat. So in regard to what they did that was helpful in the other areas of this case, why wasn't this a perfect example of deficiency? And why should we be in the role where we're deciding how this would have played out? Why shouldn't we just send it back for another sentencing?
So my first point on that, Your Honor, is the evidence of his bravery in combat absolutely did come before the fact finder in the form of his unsworn statement and was corroborated by his ORB. Appellant was prepared.
Unsworn statements aren't evidence.
Your Honor, it came in completely unrebutted before the military judge, and he stated that he would take it into account in terms of individualized sentencing. It was noted on the record by the judge that he would take into account his experience, age, and rank, as well as was mentioned earlier, the mental trauma that he may have suffered in combat experience.
It's the government's position that this wasn't defective performance under Strickland.
No.
So we don't even have to get to prejudice, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, I'm nonplussed If this wasn't deficient performance under Strickland, and I realize Strickland's a pretty low bar, but if this wasn't deficient performance under Strickland, I have real trouble imagining what he is. I mean, I suppose if defense counsel took to the bottle and slept through the case because he was intoxicated, that might do it. But come on. This is a really serious offense. And it seems to me that the prospect of a dismissal is quite high. And you don't leave this, you don't leave anything on the table. They left all kinds of stuff. Well, and that may be incorrect, because they didn't talk to these people, so they didn't even put it on the table, let alone leave it on the table. Now, how is that not deficient performance?
Your Honor, in the event this court were to find counsel deficient, it still cannot, or defense counsel or appellate counsel, can still not overcome the egregious nature of the prejudice in this case due to the egregious nature of the offenses. As was discussed earlier and mentioned by the court in ACCA, you'd be hard-pressed to find a more egregious case of not only adultery, but also the lawful disobedience of a direct order given by a superior officer, Colonel MH, to cease that adultery. And yet appellant persisted in carrying on an illicit sexual affair with the wife of a service member deployed in close combat in Afghanistan. And during the course of that illicit affair with that NCO's wife.
Captain Darko, you've kind of shifted from the first prong of Strickland to the second.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not trying to insinuate anything, but are you abandoning your position on the first prong?
Given
Judge Stuckey's comments?
I would not say I'm abandoning it, Your Honor, but certainly in the time that I have to dedicate to my argument, this case could more easily be decided, as the court states in Strickland. These cases are more easily decided on the prong of deficiency as opposed to whether counsel were deficient.
Okay, I understand. Let me ask one other question here. On the issue of, since we're talking about the second prong now.
Yes, sir.
I'm curious about these witnesses who were at issue here. And what is the government's position on why they were not even contacted? It seems to me that a defense counsel has a duty to conduct a reasonable investigation. And it's not the client who gets to decide who should be called and who should be interviewed or anything like that, is it?
No, Your Honor. You're correct. It is the counsel's duty to investigate and to call witnesses as necessary. But I think Captain MD's affidavit that he gave illuminates that a bit, where he testifies that or states that he asked the appellant over the course of these 8 months, who do you want called as witnesses? Who do you want? And when push came to shove on that meeting on 30 March when they went over the guilty plea and went through the witness production clause, the appellant gave him 7 names.
I understand that, but it goes back to my point where who cares what the client wants as far as the investigation is concerned. It seems defense counsel must at least interview these people or call them to determine who, if any of them, are going to be helpful to the cause, or how many of them, and then report back to the client and tell him or her what it is that he or she has found.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the client can get involved in the decision, can't they?
Yes, Your Honor. And Captain MD did call and interview all 7 of those witnesses that appellant provided. But of those 7 witnesses, none of the 5 were mentioned. It's not until after the trial is over and the appellant received a result that he didn't like that he said, oh, he should have called these additional 5 witnesses. But the fact is, when prompted and explained, here's who you need to call, here's what the concept of a guilty plea is and the witnesses you can have, who do you want called, he gave 7 names.
Now, he was also told, no, you can't have these guys because there's a provision in the PTA that says if they're 50 miles away, they're out. Come on, that's baloney in the first place. I don't know why counsel agreed to this. In the second place, that doesn't mean they can't testify. It just means that they can't be brought at government expense.
Correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, you don't disagree, do you, that even if the defense counsel thinks that a dismissal is off the table, that they still have a duty to try and beat the deal, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree. And defense counsel did call witnesses to go against or to put on evidence and extenuation and mitigation against the adultery.
But he called, like, lame witnesses from, like, the command that was not one that was deployed in a combat zone.
Yes, Your Honor. He called witnesses to directly rebut, first the Colonel MH to rebut the disobedience of a lawful order, and then he prepared appellant to give an unsworn to cover his combat experience, because when he asked appellant, who do you want called as your sentencing witnesses, appellant did not give any of the names of the members he had served with in combat, despite being informed that those are the types of individuals he could bring forth in sentencing. With regard to...
Captain, I know you want to continue, Captain. Darnful, but is it still an open question when the appellant provided these names to the trial defense counsel?
No, Your Honor. I believe the Dubé addressed that correctly in the three findings.
I thought it did, but I wanted to make sure.
Yes, Your Honor. To answer your question directly, the Dubé judge determined that, one, he may have mentioned these five names over the course of 8 months of representation and in excess of 34 meetings. Again, Captain Endy mentioned he met with this client more than, I believe, any other client he had been with.
Yeah, I just wanted to figure out whether your position was whether or not it's still an open question. And I guess I gather the answer is no.
No, yes, Your Honor, the answer is no.
Counsel, refresh my recollection, please. Was there something in the record that indicated that appellant here did not want to reach out to these people because he was embarrassed by the charges against him?
I believe that was, it came up as one of the questions in the Dubé hearing. I don't recall who it was addressed to, but it wasn't answered affirmatively one way or another. That was something that was insinuated and may have came up, but wasn't answered one way or another.
Thank you.
Because there was no reason for why he did not provide these five witnesses. It's his position that he mentioned them, and that defense counsel should have somehow gone and found these individuals, these additional five, without him mentioning them. I think if we look at this in terms of a client-attorney relationship, when the attorney asks the client, who do you want called after I've just explained to you all the rules, the ins and outs, who do you want called? Because he doesn't know the names, contact information of these individuals. How can he reach out and contact them if the appellant tells him, these are the seven I want, but doesn't mention those five?
So, counsel, is it your position then that a defense counsel has no duty to do independent research as to persons that a client may have served with in a combat zone?
No, Your Honor, it is not my position. But the Supreme Court in Strickland tells us that the reasonableness of an appellant or a counsel's actions are informed by the client's words and actions. And in this case, it was absolutely reasonable if the client didn't say, when asked, hey, I want these five witnesses called to testify about my experience in combat, that the attorney would not have an obligation or it wouldn't be unreasonable for them not to go out.
Do you think that that's the way that his defense counsel looks at the situation in their post-trial affidavits?
I apologize, Your Honor. Could you repeat your question?
Yes, I said, do you think that that is the way that appellant's trial defense counsel remembers the facts as reflected in their post-trial affidavits?
Remembers the with regards to the calling of the five witnesses, Your Honor?
With regards, yes.
Yes, Your Honor. My recollection of the post-trial affidavit was that, and as well as the Dubé, was that while the client may have mentioned those five names over the course of that eight-month representation, when asked about specifically who he wanted called for his sentencing, he gave seven witnesses that did not include the five.
But this goes back to a question that I think Judge Sparks and Judge Olson asked earlier. Whose job is it to make that call in the first instance?
It is the attorney's, Your Honor.
Thank you. If I could just ask a question, the PTSD that was raised in the unsworn statement,
What was that, Your Honor?
You agree that PTSD was raised in the unsworn statement and was unrebutted by the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree or disagree with this statement that the proposed testimony of the five witnesses would have given context to that PTSD and potentially at least explain some of the rather untoward and bizarre reaction of appellant in response to the rejection by this woman, MHHM, whatever her name was.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that would have informed that line, just because I don't recall any of that being contained in the record.
If it wasn't contained in the record because they didn't call the witnesses.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you don't think that a discussion of the actual circumstances and facts with respect to his combat service would potentially give context and richness to his claim of PTSD?
I think, Your Honor, coming from the horse's mouth would be the best context in this case with regard to Major Scott giving his unsworn and as corroborated by his ORB, talking about his own experiences in combat. And as we mentioned before, we had a military fact finder who would more than likely understand and state on the record that he would take into account appellant's combat experience in making his individualized sentencing decision.
Counsel, I'm going back to this term in the PT, in the PTA, that no, the government wouldn't pay for any witnesses past 50 miles. Was this negotiated and told to the accused? And basically, he said, you can't have these guys. And that was put in front of him. I mean, you're saying, well, he mentioned these guys, but he didn't mention these guys at the right time. Well, he's told he can't have these guys. So what's he going to do? He's got to get guys that are local that only knew him in a staff assignment. And frankly, they said, oh, he's a mediocre officer. Well, come on.
Your Honor,
what's going on here?
Your Honor, I think that is, with regard to his understanding of the pretrial agreement, we have a whole, I believe it was about 50-page colloquy or 20-page colloquy within the guilty plea where the judge goes through all of his rights, explains to him the witness production.
Yeah, it's a care inquiry. You do it in every guilty plea.
Yes, Your Honor, but
so, answer my question. My question is, why? The government is up here saying, well, yeah, he mentioned these names, but trial counsel didn't have a duty to investigate everybody unless he mentioned them up front at the right time. Leaving that aside, what do we make of the fact that at some point he was told he couldn't have these guys because the government wouldn't pay for them?
I don't know that he was ever told explicitly that you cannot have these guys. And Captain,
well, if he wasn't, then he didn't understand the PTA.
Your Honor, there's evidence to indicate that he did understand the PTA.
Well, was he told or wasn't he told? And how could he understand the PTA if the provision wasn't explained to him?
Your Honor, the government's position is that it was explained to him.
Okay, well, you just said, I don't know what the government's position is. Where in all of this does the fact that he couldn't have these guys, or he couldn't have these guys at government expense, explain to him?
Your Honor, that comes from Captain MD's affidavit where he talks about his conversations with the appellant and explaining to him, the ins and outs of how you can have witnesses called, and that he would need witnesses from his past to talk about his extensive military career. And that goes to the reasonableness of an attorney's actions is, again, informed by the client. If the client is telling him, I want these seven witnesses presented, then the attorney says, okay, and goes out and interviews all of them. If he doesn't include the five, then the inference is, or the presumption is, okay, I've explained to you the terms and conditions, but you don't want these five, I will go out and interview all seven that you've requested.
Thank you.
Your Honor, with regard to turning back to prejudice in this case, again, this case is more likely easily decided on the prong of prejudice simply due to the egregious nature of the offense. This is an individual who lost his wife.
So if you don't mind me interrupting, if it's all based on the egregious nature of the offense, what's the point of a sentencing hearing at all? Right? I mean, we assume, like, that there will be offenses and that they're egregious. Are you suggesting that sentencing procedures and evidence put on at sentencing are absolutely irrelevant? It's like spitting in the wind. It can make no difference. It will change nothing.
No, Your Honor. I think that there was evidence put on with regard to his service in combat that these witnesses allegedly would have testified to. That was presented before the fact finder, so it did come in.
I'll respectfully disagree.
Yes, Your Honor. And with regard to the egregious nature of offenses I was mentioning, this is, again, you'd be hard-pressed to find a more egregious case of adultery. And these five witnesses would not have changed the result. Appellant lost his right to serve as an officer in the United States Army. Pending any further questions, the government would request that the respectful request that this court affirm.
I do have one question. I won't harp on this point, but with regard to the question that Judge Ryan raised regarding the PTSD.
Yes, Your Honor.
You may not know the answer to this, and that's fine. But did counsel, presumably counsel knew about this item that was going to be included in the unsworn statement, don't you think? In other words, he would have known that the client in his unsworn statement was going to say something about this PTSD, right? Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, did the defense counsel have a duty to follow up on that issue for sentencing? And maybe he did or did not, I don't know. But would they, let's assume we don't know, but the question is, would they have had a duty with knowledge from the client that he has a diagnosis, but he feels he's suffering the effects of PTSD. Would the defense counsel have been obligated to follow up on such a statement from the client?
I would say yes, Your Honor.
Medical proof or medical examination or something like that.
Right.
I'm not suggesting that it's in this record. I just wanted to know from the government standpoint, is that something that the counsel would have been obligated to do? I guess your answer is yes.
Yes, Your Honor. If that were, those are the circumstances of this case, and I know that we've acknowledged that it's not directly contained in the record, but if that was the circumstance, then more than likely, yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Judge Ryan, do you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Working into the new normal, as we say.
You're right.
Your Honor, the government counsel said you would be hard-pressed to find a more egregious example of conduct of adultery. Assuming that is true, you would also be equally hard-pressed to find a greater showing of valor in combat than as shown by the witnesses who would have testified on behalf of the appellant. The important thing about this case, and as we focus on the prejudice prong, the important thing about this case is that, as Judge Ryan said, this is exactly what a sentencing proceeding is for. It is for the military judge, or whoever the fact finder is, to be provided with the good, the bad, and the ugly. Not just the egregious nature of the offense, but the exemplary nature of his actions in combat. Unfortunately, in this case, the military judge only got one half of the picture, and the half that he got was not very good. As the Army Court said, it was middling. Judge Ryan, specifically to your question, I would draw your attention to the joint appendix at page 075. That is where his discussion in his unsworn statement about PTSD is located. Judge, in regards to your question, the government counsel says that he gave him seven names, he called those seven names, that pretty much suffices. I would like to just talk for a second about what did not happen in this case and why that prejudiced the appellant. He did not call. A quick call through this person's ORB would have asked, would have led to several questions. Those questions are, who did you serve with in combat? Who can we speak to? Why wasn't this done? Because, as the appellant's counsel stated, we thought a dismissal was off the table. As it relates to the question of PTSD, unfortunately, the Army Dubé hearing didn't ask this question, but certainly a competent, reasonable defense counsel, upon being provided with his client's unsworn statement, and had he interviewed these five witnesses, would have known about his exemplary bravery and combat, would have quickly asked, gee, it looks to me like there may be an issue of PTSD in this case. Gee, I wonder if that mitigates the conduct for which you committed. I wonder if that explains the 85-day snapshot of an over 20-year exemplary military career. Perhaps it does. Perhaps then we go and pull the VA records and interview some physicians. Why was none of this done? Because a dismissal was off the table. In the defense counsel's eyes, this case was won. It was won before the preferral of or upon the preferral of charges. He said that himself. Both of them said that themselves. And they believed, obviously, to the extreme disadvantage of their client, that a dismissal was not even a talking point in this case. They didn't investigate. They didn't interview. They prejudiced their own client. Judge Stupi, going back to your original question, what are we asking for? We ask that this court send this case back for a sentencing rehearing. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, that will close my presentation.
Judge Ryan?
No, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 10:45.